Welcome to the Mr. Constitution Hour with Douglas V. Gibbs, a broadcast that examines our ever-changing world through the lens of the United States Constitution. Douglas V. Gibbs is on the air.
Good evening, everybody. Douglas V. Gibbs, Mr. Constitution. This is the Mr. Constitution Hour by Douglas V. Gibbs, KPRZ, 1210 AM, 106.1 FM, San Diego County, and all over the world on all of the podcast platforms, including iHeart, Odyssey, Audible, Spotify, Listen Notes, Amazon, Apple, and the list goes on and on and on. I'm glad you're listening. If you miss it live, you say, oh gosh, where can I find this live? KPRZ.com, 9 p.m. Pacific on Saturday nights. Or you can continue to listen on the podcast platform if that is how you listen. We have gone through the Constitution a couple times on this show, line by line. I am Mr. Constitution. That is what I do. The Constitution is my forte, my main thing here. But also, we have done other things on this program, and right now, we are going through U.S. history. If you've missed past episodes, you can go back once again to the podcast platforms to check it out. All right, now, let's get to our information for the evening. The colonies, we've been learning, are growing, but mercantilism is being used against them. What has happened when it comes to mercantilism, what mercantilism is, and we call it today crony capitalism, corporatism, something like that, is that the colonies were beginning to put out some pretty good products, and it was challenging the industries, or was beginning to challenge the industries in Britain. And the British manufacturers are saying, whoa, hey, this is not good for business. So they went to Parliament and asked the English government to help them out. This is collusion between government and business. And it's not a good thing. Mercantilism. So when you look at the Constitution, the system that we created, a large part of that, the large part of the fact that we limited the powers of the federal government cannot get involved in internal, local, domestic issues for the most part, there are a handful, is partly because of mercantilism, to keep our government from interfering with domestic business. Of course, now we've seen our government take a road that doesn't obey that idea, doesn't follow those principles. So I'm going to pick up now where I left off, and just for also your information, what I am reading is something I wrote. This is not somebody else's writings. This is mine. And I read some of this. Some of it I will comment along the way. What I'm reading is a book that I'm in the process of writing called A Promise of Truth, Self-Evident. It's a U.S. history book. I plan for it to be available to everybody by this summer. Curious about my books? DouglasVGibbs.com/store. Or you can go to Amazon and click in Douglas V. Gibbs, author, books, whatever. And I've got 9 books I've written, most recent being Repeal Democracy, which came out December 28th of 2022. So, let's continue through A Promise of Truth, Self-Evident. A growth in manufacturing in the northern colonies concerned English merchants and ship owners. The northern coast was full of good harbors and plenty of inexpensive lumber. To curb colonial ship owners from interfering with British trade, the Navigation Acts were passed. The laws required that a long list of articles, including sugar and tobacco, may only be traded with England. While the colonial traders wished to trade with Dutch traders and others, England disallowed it. The colonies were beginning to be viewed as a revenue source for England, of which the English were not willing to share with other countries. The northern colonies, however, found that trade with the West Indies was very profitable. Planters in Barbados, Jamaica, and other British colonies preferred to buy lumber from the Atlantic coast settlers. Colonial traders also carried on similar trade with the French and Spanish West Indies, and the taxes were lower when dealing with the French and the Spanish. The English government continued to demand that the colonies only trade with English merchants and to smuggle goods so as to trade with other colonies or countries was strictly forbidden. to stop the trade with other countries, higher taxes on goods brought into the northern colonies were imposed in 1733 by the British government. To stop the colonists from buying sugar and molasses from the French, the Sugar Act was passed. As time passed, the allowance of the colonies governing themselves independently was reduced. The interference of local management of colonial affairs led to disputes. The colonists had local governments who managed local issues. But, more and more, as time passed, the English government imposed itself on colonial affairs. Parliament began to impose laws that disallowed the colonial legislatures from making laws. If Parliament could make laws for Englishmen at home, why couldn't the colonial assemblies do the same for Englishmen in the colonies? Eventually, self-governance was taken away from the colonies. The English government entrusted the management of colonial affairs to a single set of English officials, distributing colonial affairs among different departments of the English administration. Charters were eventually taken away, and royal agents began to impose their will on the colonies. Customs officials were appointed to enforce trade laws. Like the Navigation Acts and the Sugar Act, juries of colonists refused to convict those who disobeyed these laws. So the British set up admiralty courts, where a judge appointed by the king decided without a jury whether the person accused was guilty. The trade laws, as the English government tightened enforcement, became very unpopular. Now, as this is going on, as we're seeing taxation increase, we also saw something else going on in the colonies. Their spiritual nature of the colonies, the virtuousness of the people, had been changing. You got to remember, this is important because it ties into all of this. It ties into, well, let me back up. If you don't know right from wrong, or you live a life where right means whatever you decide it means, then it's harder to recognize tyranny. It's harder to recognize when something is wrong. So when it comes to our Christianity, we need to be right with God. This is a part of our relationship with Christ, our relationship with the Lord God, is that because we have that relationship, because we envelop ourselves completely in His Word, we are able to recognize right, wrong, and in between. And I will kind of explain a little bit of that in a minute with what I read, but I wanted to kind of create some groundwork here. So the faith of the colonists was key when it came to their ability to recognize that what was going on in the colonies, what the British were doing to the colonists, was wrong. They needed to be right with God to recognize that tyranny. Just like in today's society, we have a society that has decided God's law, the rule of law, our moral standard no longer matters. And therefore, when something is wrong, it is not only not recognized, it is championed, it is welcomed. And so what we're seeing in our political system is the rise of tyranny. We're seeing our government and our culture deteriorate. We've watched people become deceptive, despotic, and we're watching, in for lack of a better way of saying it, a very, very immoral turn in our culture. And I don't need to get into the examples. I think you recognize them. The fact that we're allowing our, and even encouraging our children to decide, you know, I don't want to be that sexy anymore. And then, you know, girls, you know, in their teens having full mastectomies, children being encouraged to have their bodies surgically changed, or kindergartners being told they can be whatever they want, male or female, regardless of what biology says, regardless of what their DNA says, and also that they can chase after same-sex desires. And while I don't believe there should be laws against certain parts of that I do believe there should be laws because they are hurting children with surgeries, for example, I do believe that our culture, by accepting this, is putting us in a position where we can't recognize right or wrong. And so now we have a tyrannical system rising. Some might call it the swamp. You know, we've heard that term before. The deep state that's operating any way it wants. Nothing to worry about. Why? Because we can't even recognize that what they're doing is tyrannical because we can't even figure out which bathroom to use. So it's important for us to be right with God. If we're not right with God, we can't maintain a system of liberty. Or as I like to say, how can we get our political house in order if we can't get our religious house in order? If we've got pastors, we've got congregations, we've got a Christian community, we've got a church that is way off base, how can we survive the sinful everything that's hitting us? Now, that all said, understand that the founders, the settlers actually in America, went through a crisis in which the Word of God was being compromised. The pastors were watering down the Word, and so on and so forth. So that's what I'm going to get into next. So before the emergence of America's Age of Enlightenment, and after the establishment of the first colonies, a crisis emerged. All political systems are temporary in nature. After all, they are created by man. Man's observations and biblical texts have reached the same conclusion. Humanity is a flawed species. We are well aware of those flaws. The Christian faith is based on the premise that humans fall short of the glory of God. The foundation of American society rests upon the idea that the Creator cares for His flock, despite our flaws. And when the culture is a virtuous one, He provides protection and guidance. Benjamin Franklin, in a letter to the, I'm not going to pronounce this, Abschalut, so it's Abbeschalut, two different words, and Arnaud, Arnaud, dated April 17, 1787, a few weeks before the commencement of the Constitutional Convention in Philadelphia, wrote, "Only a virtuous people are capable of freedom. As nations become corrupt and vicious, they have more need of masters." Alexander Tytler, a Scottish political philosopher who lived during the time of the American Revolution and the early years of the United States as a country, explained that as one looks back in history, democratic systems and republics each follow a similar cycle. The Tytler cycle begins with bondage, and from there, the cycle moves through a spiritual awakening, courage, liberty, prosperity, selfishness, complacency, apathy, dependence, and back to bondage. It is important to note that the first step away from bondage is a spiritual awakening. The first cultural crisis that the English colonists encountered was the result of a falling away from their adherence to faith. The bondage of sin had gripped society, and it was the role of the preachers to lead the culture to a biblical solution. While America was still developing as a group of English colonies, the culture experienced two spiritual awakenings. The first great awakening was ignited in 1734. Reverend Jonathan Edwards recognized that the God-fearing generation that had settled the New World was gone, and their grandchildren and great-grandchildren were struggling with immorality, debauchery, and extreme self-interest. He suggests the conditions that led to the compromise of the Christian faith in the colonies began in 1662 when, in order to encourage congregants to attend church, the leading ministers in the Massachusetts colony decided to water down their teachings with the halfway covenant. The watering down of the message included an acceptance by the culture that achieving only half righteousness that God demanded was good enough. Having one foot in the world was considered fine. The pastors preached that as long as you were following God's commandments 51% of the time, you could come to church, partake of communion, and still have a pathway to God's kingdom. James chapter 2, verses 14 through 17, explain that faith without works is dead. What does it profit, my brethren, if someone says he has faith but does not have works? Can faith save him? If a brother or sister is naked and destitute of daily food, and one of you says to them, Depart in peace, be warmed and filled, but you do not give them the things which are needed for the body, what does it profit? Thus also faith by itself, if it does not have works, is dead. The church was encouraging the idea that works was so minor that living a largely immoral life was fine as long as it didn't go beyond the halfway mark. Halfway membership in the body of Christ became socially acceptable, and before long, these halfway covenanters eventually even made their way into the ministry. By the time Reverend Edwards was on the scene, church leadership was realizing that the halfway covenant had been a terrible mistake. Something remarkable was needed to reignite the flickering flame of Christianity in the colonies. Edwards referred to 1 Timothy chapter 1, verse 17. Now unto the God eternal, immortal, invisible, the only wise God, be honor and glory forever and ever. Amen. With God, you are either all in or you are not. He is the only wise God, and either he receives all glory and honor from believers or none. There is no middle ground. Lukewarm is the same as cold, and in fact, lukewarm is worse than cold. So, in 1734, Edwards began a series of sermons with the verse in 1 Timothy at the bow of the spiritual ship he was guiding out of the harbor of a lukewarm society on justification by faith alone. He laid on thick the concept that without works, your faith is dead. You are known by your fruit. And he hammered home an awe-inspiring viewpoint of God's sovereignty. To receive God's blessing, you must throw yourself on the mercy of God who showed his overflowing goodness in giving his son to die. Edwards identified the wickedness in the colonies. He called out the sin, each of the sins, one by one. Irreverence of God's house, disregard of the Sabbath, neglect of family prayer, disobedience to parents, quarreling, greediness, sensuality, hatred of one's neighbor. Every secret sin was held up for all to see. He preached that when you accept Christ, you become a completely new creature in him. You do not become half of a new creature. Your old self must be completely washed away so that the new creature in Christ may serve him, grow in him, and minister in him, or minister for him. Hearts were changed, and souls were heavy with shame and guilt. The town was uplifted by the message, and people returned to the ways of the Lord. And then the message spread to the other towns. People gathered to pray in their homes and in public places. Shops closed up for prayer. The public assemblies became a thing to behold. The congregation became alive in God's service, and the people became mindful of the importance of public worship. Every person became eager to drink in the words of Edwards' ministry and fellowship with their fellow Christians in the process. Tears flowed. Some tears were from weeping and sorrow and distress. Others were tears of joy and love, and others were pity and concern for the souls of their neighbors. Day and night, news of new conversions became commonplace. Day and night, people visited Edwards Church for conversion, or simply to ask for help or counsel in other areas. Soon, the revival caught fire in other towns. Before long, over 100 communities were experiencing the flames of revival and the warmth of the glow of God's glory and mercy. Edwards had touched off a revival fire that was burning brighter each day and sweeping through the surrounding communities with ferocious righteousness. Word reached England, so a pastor decided to visit from Great Britain to find out what was going on. George Whitfield observed the blaze of revival in Northampton, Massachusetts, and the surrounding communities and joined in. He spent time talking to Edwards, telling the pastor that his message needed to be spread farther. Then, with Edwards' help, Whitfield embarked on a journey across all of the colonies. He grabbed the wildfire of revival Edwards had torched and swept the hot embers throughout the rest of New England and into the South. Edwards had served as a fire starter. Whitfield served as the tinder and the strong wind that fanned the flames even hotter and even brighter as they moved through the colonies, touching every corner of the land. The message that the message of the gospel compels a personal decision that will change an ordinary person into a completely new person or creature had taken a firm hold on America. As a result, the colonies returned to being a virtuous society. Benjamin Franklin, who often heard Edwards speak, said that, quote, every accent, every emphasis, every modulation of voice was so perfectly tuned and well-placed that one without being interested in the subject could not help being pleased with the discourse, unquote. From 1738 to 1770, Whitfield made 7 journeys to the colonies from Great Britain. He preached from the southern end to the northern tip of the colonies. Ministers were among the converts, too. While having dinner with fellow ministers in Stamford, Connecticut, Whitfield spoke vigorously to his fellow ministers at the table against the practice of sending unconverted persons into the ministry. 2 ministers, tearful and full of regret, quickly and publicly confessed that they laid hands on young men without so much as asking them whether they were born again through the blood of Jesus Christ or not. Other ministers also took up the revival torch. One could say that based on Tytler's cycle, that the spiritual faith ignited by the first great awakening provided the courage needed for the colonists to seek and fight for independence, which came 40 years after Edwards began his revival. And then from the courage came victory, liberty, and prosperity. Later, a second great awakening occurred after the Declaration of Independence, the Revolutionary War, the writing of the Constitution, and the proposal and ratification of the Bill of Rights. Like the first great awakening, the second great awakening lasted at least 40 years. A third great awakening began in the 1850s. And reached well into the 20th century. It was the third Great Awakening that guided the American culture through the invasion of the Progressive Era, the promise of the Industrial Revolution, and the horrors of the 2 World Wars. As a result of all 3 Great Awakenings, the number of Christians in the country increased in number, and Christians became more involved civically, socially, and politically in their community. They did more to preserve the virtuous nature of American culture. It is perhaps prudent to recognize that the fourth Great Awakening may be on the horizon, considering today's culturally compromised society. 2 Chronicles 7:14, if my people, which are called by my name, shall humble themselves and pray and seek my face and turn from their wicked ways, then will I hear from heaven and will forgive their sin and will heal their land. John Adams offered, suppose a nation in some distant region should take the Bible for their only law book, and every member should regulate his conduct by the precepts there exhibited. Every member would be obliged in conscience to temperance, frugality, and industry, to justice, kindness, and charity towards his fellow men, and to piety, love, reverence toward Almighty God. What a utopia, what a paradise would this region be? David Barton's wall builders went through over 15,000 writings and some 3,154 quotations. And the research revealed that the single most cited authority in the writings of the founding era of the United States was the Holy Bible. 34% of the documented quotes were taken from the Bible, a percentage almost 4 times higher than the second most quoted source, John Locke. The signers of the Constitution acknowledged that the principle girding the separation of powers was the same principle found in Jeremiah 17:9. Many other verses also exist in the embodiment of the Constitution. Jeremiah 17:9 reads, "The heart is deceitful above all things and desperately wicked. Who can know it?" All right, so let's now move on a little bit. So we've got mercantilism beginning. Then we talked about the Great Awakening. Let's get back to the mercantilism now. Let's see what the clash of industries and the rise of British tyranny, it was really all about. Now remember, I want you to keep in mind this. The whole reason for going through the Great Awakening is that had that Great Awakening not happened, this tyranny may not have been recognized by the people. But because of the Great Awakening, because of the fact that it became a virtuous society, the recognition of right and wrong, of the rule of law, was much more prevalent in that society, in that culture. And that's very important. It's a very important part of the journey of the American colonists. So as the English settlements grew, they began to produce goods that exceeded the quality of the products being manufactured by English merchants. The merchants in England became not only concerned that the colonists may no longer require goods from them, but that eventually colonial goods might compete with British products or English products in Europe. In response, the English Parliament passed a Woolen Act, which disallowed woolen goods from being traded among the colonies, nor between each town. Any weaved cloth, by law, could not leave the place it was produced. No longer could a colonial merchant sell woolen products to any settlements nearby their town. Northern colonies began to produce beaver hats, and any commercial trading or sales of those hats were treated similarly as was the woolen products. Despite the fact that the hats were made from superior domestic beaver fur, and that the hats made in New England and New York had become so popular that hats were being shipped as far as Spain, English hatters appealed to Parliament to stop any competition from the colonies being able to send their products to any market outside their own towns. Parliament replied, ordering that no hats may be sent by the colonists from one place to another. The penalty was set at £500. Scraps of animal hides became popular among the shoemakers, especially after Massachusetts passed laws to prevent a waste of hides. Shoemakers from England taught the colonial farmers how to make shoes, and during winter, after harvest, but before planting season, farmers spent a part of their days making shoes for their families. Some made extra shoes and offered them for sale. Shoes made in Massachusetts became popular among the colonies, and the English government decided it would not interfere with the colonial shoe industry or leather trade as long as the products remained within the colonies. Iron as a raw material was a small industry in Britain, and so the English Parliament and the iron industry in England decided to leave the colonial furnaces alone. Early furnaces in the New World worked with bog iron, which was found in the swampy regions. Better ore was ultimately located in the hills of Connecticut, New York, Pennsylvania, and Virginia. Due to the British Isles, to their knowledge, not being rich in metals when it came to raw resources, the English iron manufacturers were happy to purchase pig iron from the colonial furnaces. The alternative for the English would require them to purchase it from the Swedes or Russians. Later in history, it would be discovered that English was actually blessed with rich ores. While the English merchants were happy to allow the colonists to sell to the motherland the ores mined in the English colonies, manufacturing was a different consideration. At the time, England was using charcoal to melt the ores. It had not yet been discovered that coal could also be used to do the job, and during that particular period in history, English charcoal was running low. However, the English merchants did not wish for the colonists to manufacture products from their ore, for it would interfere with English commerce. If the colonists could work up the pig iron into plates or tools of iron or steel, the products could be sold and lessen the sale of English products. So, as with woolen products and hats, the English merchants appealed to Parliament, and the English lawmakers passed laws forbidding the colonists from setting up any iron or steel mills for the purpose of manufacturing products that may compete with those manufactured by their English counterparts. Smaller items used locally were allowed, however. Some farmers, for example, made nails, tacks, and simple tools and sold them locally to their neighbors. A hammer, an anvil, and a small furnace in the chimney corner of living rooms became common for that function, enabling small local industries to emerge. The British government looked the other way as long as the products did not leave their localities and compete with markets established by English merchants. Materials for use by the British Navy were encouraged in the colonies. Naval stores or materials used to build ships were less expensive when they originated in the colonies. The Carolinas sent 60,000 barrels to England every year. Virginia and Maryland sent thousands of tons of hemp annually to England, a product that could not be raised in the mother country. New England offered lumber. Mercantilism. To really get now into the deep nitty-gritty of that, let's kind of now see what started happening. So the English looked upon the colonies as a tool that may produce for the British Isles the various goods they needed. They did not wish for the colonies to serve as competition. The primary interest was that what was best for the motherland, not the colonies. As the people were considered to be subjects under the ruling class in European countries, the English colonies were considered to be nothing more than a land whose people were inferior to their European counterparts, and the colonies existed to serve and enrich the British Empire as a whole, a small cog in a much larger machine that was expected to serve its role, but to not create any disruption in British commercial interests. The Englishmen in the colonies viewed the way they were being perceived by England was that they were not entitled access to the same natural rights and their brethren across the Atlantic were granted. The interests of English merchants, ship owners, and the government were more important than the interest or welfare of the colonists. The English colonies had more goods to offer than what was simply desired by the English in Britain. The colonists realized that they had materials and products desired by other trading partners, such as France, Spain, and Germany. The northern colonists in particular wished to trade their lumber with other countries, a product they could offer at a price lower than any of their potential competitors. The Atlantic coast of the colonies was full of good harbors, and colonial ship owners were more than ready to navigate trade routes with the New World and Old World destinations. The Navigation Acts of 1651 and 1660 were designed to restrict trade to only England and not allow foreign imported goods into the colonies. The acts were passed by the English Parliament with the aim of impeding the Dutch traders, and products like sugar and tobacco was only allowed to be shipped to England. And if any colonial traders wished to send their products to other foreign markets where they could earn higher profits, it was forbidden. Only the English merchants, once they received the goods from the colonies, could trade with the other European traders. The European trader, in turn, ended up paying much more for the product from the English than what they would have had to pay if it had come directly from a colonial merchant. The mother country saw nothing wrong with their mercantilistic practice because the purpose of the colonies, from their perspective, was to benefit the British Empire. Certainly, the colonies did not exist for their own benefit. The colonists disagreed, considering the English system of mercantilism to be despotic and unfair. Colonial shipmasters ignored the navigation laws, transporting sugar and tobacco directly to Europe. If arrested for breaking the navigation laws, the colonial traders would stand trial back in the colonies, where colonial juries would find them not guilty. Trade with the West Indies was particularly profitable for the English colonies, especially for the northern colonies. The planters in Barbados, Jamaica, and other English islands also found trade with the Atlantic coast colonies to yield large profits. Raising sugar became a primary activity in the West Indies. Rather than spend the time raising food or cutting timber, it was more profitable to sell sugar to the English colonies along the Atlantic coast and then buy food and lumber from those same colonies. Hundreds of ships participated in trade from New England, New York, and the Delaware River with the West Indies. The North American colonies sent horses, oxen, sheep, hogs, fish, corn, peas, beans, oats, and flour. Sometimes even house frames and staves and hoops for sugar barrels were sent to the island colonies. In return, the colonial shipmasters brought back sugar, molasses, and money. The money would then in turn be used to buy articles from England that were not produced in the 13 colonies. Colonial traders also conducted business with the French and Spanish West Indies. The English islands taxed their products much higher than their French and Spanish counterparts. Also, the English island colonies could not always satisfy the full need of the colonies to the north along the Atlantic coast. France and Spain had passed similar laws restricting trade with their colonies to only their European counterparts, so French and Spanish planters preferred trading with the English colonies because their food prices were lower than from the countries in Europe. As a result, for fear of being caught by any of the European countries, colonial shipmasters became smugglers. Once the English island colonies realized that the colonial traders from 13 colonies along the Atlantic coast to their north were also trading with France and Spanish island colonies, the English colonies in the Atlantic and Caribbean Sea began to complain to the English Parliament or government. In 1733, the English Parliament placed high taxes on products from other regions to the New World being brought into the northern colonies. The Sugar Act was largely ignored, however, and the smuggling continued. Juries of colonists would not convict those who disobeyed the law, so the English government established admiralty courts in the colonies where a judge appointed by the king decided the fate of the accused rather than a jury. The removal of trial by jury angered the colonists even more, making the trade laws even more unpopular, which in turn encouraged more to disobey the tyrannical laws. Punishments were severe and believed to be excessive and unusual by the colonists. Executions were public and handbills were circulated among the crowds and the townsfolk to explain the crimes committed and reveal the punishment as a warning to the rest of the colony's residents. As the colonies grew, the British government decided to change course on how to govern them. At first, the political leaders and monarchy in England allowed the colonists to govern themselves. And as the colonies grew in size and prosperity, English interference in the management of colonial affairs increased. The colonists perceived the intrusions as tyrannical, believing that their natural rights were in danger. Disputes became commonplace. Consent of the governed with an emphasis on localism was the original stance in the English colonies. Towns conducted town meetings to settle matters such as care for common fields, the roads, ferries, bridges, and fences. In the southern colonies, where town meetings were less convenient, the governors of the colonies appointed justices of the peace to manage county affairs. Each colony also possessed a local legislature, largely modeled after the English Parliament. The head of the colonial government was a governor, chosen by a democratic vote in Connecticut, Rhode Island, and originally in Massachusetts, until it was changed by Charles II to appointment by the king. In Pennsylvania and Maryland, the governor was appointed by the proprietor. In all of the other colonies, the governor was appointed by the king. Laws created by colonial legislatures could be vetoed by the governor, and by veto from the government in England. Such vetoes could not be overridden. Disputes between legislatures and governors led to attacks on colonial charters by England. In 1684, the Charter of Massachusetts was taken away. In 1691, after the Glorious Revolution of 1688 in England, Massachusetts received a new charter, but this one disallowed them to choose their own governor. Under the new charter, Plymouth was united with Massachusetts into a single colony. In 1701, a party in Parliament, attempted to take away the charters of Rhode Island and Connecticut, and while the proposals were unsuccessful, the colonists recognized that it was an attempt to weaken the Quakers in Pennsylvania and the Puritans in New England. While most written literature in the form of books and pamphlets came from England and Europe, a few were printed in the English colonies. In 1638, a printing press was set up in Massachusetts, and while newspapers at this time were uncommon even in Europe, with the first emerging in England in 1622, the Boston Newsletter began being printed in the colonies in 1704. The New York Gazette was first issued November 8th, 1725, a small two-page paper. In Pennsylvania, Benjamin Franklin launched a newspaper with his partner, Hugh Meredith, the Pennsylvania Gazette, in 1728, a publication that lasted until 1800. It was the second newspaper to be published in Philadelphia. The first was American Weekly Mercury, published by Andrew Bradford in 1723. Franklin's Gazette became the most successful newspaper in the colonies. Almanacs were also popular, one of which was published by Benjamin Franklin called the Poor Richard's Almanac. Franklin's publication of his almanac began in 1732 under a pseudonym, Richard Saunders. He continued to publish his almanac for 25 years, a publication that not only brought Franklin economic success, but earned him great popularity. The publication contained a calendar, a list of eclipses, many bits of history, proverbs, and practical advice. Franklin's almanac cost less than a book or newspaper to purchase and was also popular because of its rhymes, jokes, and quaint sayings such as early to bed, early to rise makes a man healthy, wealthy, and wise. Around 1750, the colonists began to venture beyond the great Appalachian barrier. Traders from the Carolinas and Georgia traveled as far west as the Mississippi River. Traders from Virginia, Pennsylvania, and New York began to venture into the Ohio River Valley. As the populations increased, settlers followed the trails of the traders, searching for new lands to occupy in the vast region up to the west. While there were some French settlements to the west in places like the Illinois country, the French settlements were small, rarely more heavily populated than 500 inhabitants. Both the English and the French claimed the lands between the Appalachian Mountains and the Mississippi River. The French governor of Canada and the English in Virginia both claimed the Ohio country. In 1753, the Ohio Company began to settle the Ohio region with plans to construct a fort near the intersection of the Allegheny and Monongahela Rivers. I hope I pronounce that. It's Monongahela, where they joined to form the Ohio River. Governor Duquesne in Canada dispatched 1,000 men to the Ohio country to build French forts in the hopes of stopping the advance of the English intruders. News of Duquesne's operations alarmed the Ohio Company, and they sent Major George Washington to demand that the French withdraw. The 21-year Old was familiar with the Virginia frontier and had already engaged in surveying. Washington gathered a team of men to join him, and the journey took 6 weeks. He found the French commander at Fort Lebeuf near the northern boundary of Pennsylvania. The French commander claimed that the French king was master of all the country west of the Allegheny Mountains. As Virginians hurried towards the Ohio River to build a fort, the French descended down the Allegheny River in cones to drive away the workmen and construct their own fort. They named it Fort Duquesne in honor of the governor of Canada. A large force of Virginians met the French, and an armed confrontation ensued. The French claimed the Virginians fired the first shots, and the leader of the French and 20 of his men were killed. The remaining French force surrendered to the Virginians. Fort Necessity was then constructed by the Virginians. War broke out over the disagreements regarding the land in Ohio. The French and Indian War, also known as the Seven Years' War, was not declared for 2 years, but the skirmishes were recognized as an engagement of war. In Europe, the drums of war also began to pound. France and Russia combined forces with Maria Theresa of Austria to confront Frederick the Great of Prussia regarding territory taken by Prussia in the previous war. England came to the aid of Frederick from Prussia. Meanwhile, in addition to the war in Europe and the confrontations between France and the English in North America, England and France began to fight in India. The English navy was superior to the French navy, but the French boasted more soldiers than the English. In North America, with the colonists also lending troops to the fight, the French were expected to be overwhelmed in time. The Indian populations west of the English colonies allied with the French, seeing the encroaching English as intruders. English expansion had spoiled good hunting grounds, and the French did little to interfere with Indian lands. In 1754, fearing the Iroquois might join the Western Indians against the English in the war, a conference at Albany was held. The Iroquois took no sides and for the time being were willing to remain at peace with the English. Benjamin Franklin, a delegate from Pennsylvania, recognized the need for the colonies to be united in the fight. In his Pennsylvania Gazette, a picture of a wriggling snake cut into pieces with the initial letter of a colony at each piece was printed, under which were the words, "Join or Die." The political cartoon was based upon an old superstition that claimed if a snake was cut up and the pieces were allowed to touch, the pieces would knit themselves back together and the snake would live. The message by Franklin was clear. The uniting of the colonies was a necessity. Without uniting, they would perish. While some viewed Franklin's plan as favorable, the colonies did not adopt any plan for unification. Few persons viewed a union of colonies as necessary at the time. The colonists identified themselves with their colony, not any union. They were Virginians or New Yorkers or Pennsylvanians. The Quakers in Pennsylvania did not favor war and were opposed to war of any kind, especially a war over territory. The southern colonies felt disconnected to what was going on and feared the Spaniards and Indian tribes in their area more than the French in the Ohio region. In 1755, the English government sent two regiments to assist in the war in North America. General Braddock was the leader of the British force arriving from Britain, and he was ignorant of the style of fighting occurring in the wilderness against the Indians and the French woodsmen. As Braddock's company got within about 8 miles of Fort Duquesne, a French force with many Indians attacked Braddock's force from all sides. As Washington's Virginians scattered into the trees, Braddock's men remained in line, following the strict discipline of warfare as it was fought in Europe. By the end of the battle, Braddock was mortally wounded and 63 of his men, all but 20, and had been killed or disabled. Washington led both the British and American armies to the nearest refuge, accompanied by a young woodsman from North Carolina by the name of Daniel Boone. Following Washington's retreat, the French and their Indian allies raided various frontier settlements of Virginia, Pennsylvania, and Maryland. While the border was successfully defended by Washington's men, who were armed with homemade flintlock muskets, tomahawks, and scalping knives, the English were unable to dislodge the French from the region. William Pitt in 1757 took over as the English Prime Minister. As the colonies increased their share of troops for the war, Pitt supplied some troops, tents, arms, and ammunition. In 1758, the English captured a line of French posts, naming the cluster of traders' cabins at the site Pittsburgh in honor of the Parliament's Prime Minister. The French abandoned Fort Duquesne due to having a lack of troops to defend it, and by 1762, the English controlled 9/10 of the French ships of war. The loss of their naval fleet led France to be unable to supply the French troops in North America. Among the French losses was Quebec in 1759. In 1760, Montreal surrendered. The war in America came to a close after that, but the war in Europe dragged on for 3 years longer. Spain entered the war during that time, joining sides with France. As did the French, Spain also suffered defeat, and the British captured Havana in Cuba and Manila in the Philippine Islands in the process. In 1763, peace was achieved, and France abandoned all possessions east of the Mississippi River. Spain gave up Florida and France and gave Spain New Orleans and the French territories west of the Mississippi River. By the end of the war, the English had control of all of Florida and Canada, reserving the regions north of Florida from the Allegheny Mountains to the Mississippi River to the local Indian population. While the English government intended to open these lands up in the future to English settlement, for the time being, settlers in those lands were warned to leave so that the dangers of Indian attack would be lessened. The colonists viewed the British policy as a sign of disrespect for the claims of the different colonies, and largely disobeyed the royal proclamation that limited settlement in the frontier. Some of the Western Indian populations were not willing to submit to English rule and united under the leadership of Pontiac, a chief of the Pottawatomies. They attacked all English posts from Detroit to Niagara. Indians of the Ohio Valley attacked posts in western Pennsylvania and advanced into the central part of the colony, but they soon realized that they were not going to drive the English away and eventually ceased hostilities. In the northern colonies, despite the war with the French, were reluctant to break off their trade with the French West Indies. The activities of the colonial traders angered William Pitt in Britain, and he resolved to use British troops to find smuggled goods, even if it meant breaking into storehouses and other places where the smuggled goods might be stashed. All right, so we've talked about mercantilism, the Great Awakening, and then mercantilism again right there at the end, where the British are saying, no, you can't trade with the French. We're not going to allow it. And we're even going to break into your storehouses and other places where you might be smuggling or holding smuggled goods so that we can catch you in the act and punish you. All right, so that's it for this week. We will continue next week. United we stand, combined we kick butt. God bless America. My friends, God bless you. Thank you for spending the time with me. See you next week.